This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Beltaloda, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back with one final episode for Season 5 to do a sort of wrap-up, get everybody's feedback, gather all the thoughts, and sort of go through some of the questions that we have after the end of the season and things we hope to see in the future, all that kind of stuff. So I've got like 10 pages of, I know pages don't translate to anything really, but I got like 10 pages of emails, plenty of stuff to talk about. And most of the stuff is brought up by the listeners that I would have discussed anyway. So I'm going to kind of leave it mostly to them. What are you feeling at the end of season 5?
Here's the four things I came out of the episode really wanting to know more about. And I don't know how many, I got a definitive answer on one thing. And I'll maybe talk about that first. I expressed confusion on the podcast about what exactly blew up the Serio Mall, or maybe it's Koto. I think the Koto went out first, but I mentioned there's this round kind of like drone looking thing that was orbiting the Serio Mall. And I couldn't tell if it's a defensive drone or what, but like, you know, and then, you know, we've said many times our screener copies are not the highest resolution.
Yeah.
But this weekend we watched it again with our audience, and I still, even with the high quality copy, I was still perplexed at exactly how, and people said, oh, well, it's the railgun round, or, oh, it's a torpedo hitting, or, oh, it's actually the Rocinante. And I was pretty dismissive about all that stuff when I was watching it in high def. I actually found a really great breakdown of the combat on YouTube where a guy went through and actually like drew the firing arcs and like labeled like railgun shot 1, 2. It's like going through the Zapruder film and trying to decide who shot Kennedy from the grassy knoll. Mm-hmm. And what I've concluded is the Rocinante, with its initial salvo of railguns, took out the Serio Mall's drive cone and then accelerated around it, and Bull did a Tokyo Drift style, keeping the nose of the Rocinante pointed at the Serio Mall as it blew past it, and just ripped it with like railgun, 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 eventually hitting its reactor and exploding. And the reason it looks like some kind of defensive drone is because it's A, in the background, and number one, you're only seeing the kind of weird front end view of the Rocinante with all this pitons and shit sticking out of it. So gotcha. It doesn't look like the elongated, sleek Rocinante. It looks like a little beach ball streaking past it. So I'm going to, in the show notes, link the breakdown of the battles in the show. It's like a 3-minute long YouTube video that just lays out all the firing arcs, and it made it much, much clearer. I wonder in the future, because it's something we both remarked on, like, I love the hyper-realistic style of this combat, but it is a little bit harder to, it was a little bit harder for us to understand. I wonder if they need to really think about the visual language of this and think about, like, firing arcs and lines. And if you're going to be going, hopping around 10,000 kilometers in a second, mm-hmm. you really got to make sure the viewer knows where the hell their point of view is.
It's definitely a problem, or it's something for them to consider, because I was certainly confused by most of the action that was happening there. I mean, you take away the big things you need to take away, right? Like Holden and his crew, the Rossi survived, Drummer survived, Oksana survived, but all these ships were disabled and the threat is gone. Like, you get all that. But if you really want to follow that action and understand how it happened, you got to dig in. They maybe need to, so much of this is filmed from so close, and I know the distances that they're firing from are way larger than you would think. Maybe they need to zoom out a little bit at some points, like show the setup, because that was one of the things, like, we never saw the setup of this battle. We know, okay, Drummer's fleet is headed one direction, Holden's headed toward them. When does that change? Somewhere along the way, like, Holden, you know, rushes into the middle of the pack. His intention is to, like, zoom right through them, right? Firing at them with all his cannons on the way through. But that changes somewhere in the middle, and they don't do a great job of communicating how the flight pattern would change as well.
I feel like some of the other, like, the one I really think about is the Rocinante's duel with the stealth ship around the station, that the protomolecule station, and I think season one, maybe season two, and like how, you know, we are always kind of like in a third person view behind the Rocinante as it's kind of spinning and twisting, and like,
yeah,
what that shot would have looked like if we were like standing on the space station, or from the stealth ship's point of view, where it's like the Rocinante just pops out from behind and like rakes it with fire and it kind of streaks across, and like we might be confused, especially if there was like 12 other hostiles, you know, in the battle. I wonder, like, if instead of, if we had just like been with the Rocinante, like, you know, over its right shoulder as it takes out the drive cone and then, you know, sluices around the Serial Mall, or if we, you know, you talked a lot about maybe needing a few more insert shots, like if they had an insert shot of Holden being like fire, you know, so as the Rocinante opened up with its rail guns, something, because it does feel like that, like, it's not fatal, but like when I was reading through these Reddit threads, like there was literally hundreds of people being like, man, I was really confused. And there's like one or two insufferable assholes being like, well, it's perfectly clear if you put it. I was like, OK, well, that's fine. If it's clear to you, there's 100 people here saying it wasn't clear. That means for a show that wants to have broad appeal, they probably ought to think a little bit more about the visual language that they admittedly are pioneering. Like, there's not a go to of how you show this particular type of combat. And they've done it really well. And this, I think, was for the most part really well. It's just a little confusing in the implementation of it. So,
and crucially, it's in those bigger battles, right? Because it's easy to follow when it's one ship on one ship, and we've seen that a lot.
Of course, and it seems like next year there's going to be some large fleet battles, or the potential of those, like.
And so we start to see, like,
maybe you want to sweat
the beginning of that at the ring at the end of this episode, this finale, right?
Sure.
Like, it's also easy to communicate it when you have a reference point, like the ring gate.
Yeah.
It's really hard to communicate it when it's in just the middle of space, blackness all around you. All you have is the ships. It's tough. But yeah
that ring gate was a lot easier to understand because there's just, there's always, like, you know, kind of two sides. You had Marco's ships coming in stealth. And then the three giant, you know, behemoths, not the real behemoths, but, you know, the Nathan Hale class destroyers and the Doniger destroyer or battleships. Mm-hmm. And then you had the micrometeor thing that shredded them. And then, you know, you had the ring gate firing, you know, betraying them. And then you had the Martian betrayers coming in. Everything seemed like it was very easy, much easier to understand. Yeah. And so they can do it. It's just, when you have a real furball, like you did with the different Belter fleet, and they're backstabbing, you got the Rocinante and all these torpedoes and railguns going off, especially since the Rocinante, like, we've never really seen it fire its railgun in anger. Like, it's done a test shot and it's done some shots to, like, use it as a booster thing, but, like, it's kind of like a new visual thing.
Yeah.
Not a lot of ships of Rocinante size has a railgun. In fact, I think it's now the only ship that does of its size. Well, once the stealth frigates were destroyed. So maybe a little tighten it up there. I don't want to belabor that point too much. The other three things, and maybe order of importance, ascending order of importance. First, what is the deal with Monica? That's something we said all season long. Why was Monica so important to Marco? Like, I understand, like, why they kidnapped her and all that kind of stuff, but why did they try to take her off the station along with the protomolecule? Was it just tying up a loose end, or is she useful for his purposes beyond that? And was that purpose frustrated, or am I thinking about something that's no longer important anymore? Because I felt like they set that importance up. Do you have any? Am I barking up the right tree, wrong tree, or
the fact that they kept her alive in that cargo container says everything you need to know about whether or not they want her, right? So I mean, you know, we speculated earlier in the season when that was all going down that maybe they want her for her, you know, ability to get some kind of message out and be a trusted source for news, right? Maybe force her to say a bunch of lies that then will be taken at face value because she's Monica.
She was the one that's like, because he, you know, Marco clearly thinks a lot about propaganda, the symbolism of things. That's why he was so, I mean, it's not the only reason he was so hot for the Rocinante. There's also some personal jealousy there, but you know, the symbol of Belter, Martian, and Earther cooperation had to be destroyed. Monica being kind of like that trusted third party voice that covered the ring gate. You know, unity, maybe he sees some utility in perverting her role to like be the mouthpiece of disunity. I don't know. But it's an open question I had that I don't feel like I felt like the show didn't even think about it in its final moments. It's like it setted that up and then it's like, yeah, so I don't know if this is something that I'm supposed to pay attention to going forward or just forget about the fact that. Because clearly Marco had a lot of things he wanted to do, mm-hmm. And a lot of that stuff was thwarted. So like maybe this is just one of those others. The other question is, man, these are like 1A, 1B. How bad is the Earth fucked? We talked about them playing coy with that, and I almost think it's because they wanted to punt that the next season. Like themselves weren't sure, especially if they're going to shut things down for this final season. I think you and I both think that that's more of a negotiating tactic than an actual end of the line. But like maybe they wanted to have flexibility of like, well, maybe the Earth just lost a billion people and it's definitely a bad situation and it's going to set them back economically, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not fatal. But it seems to me, because here's the thing I read, I watched after in between last week and this week, Alt Shift X. If you don't know Alt Shift X, he does a really great YouTube series of breaking down like themes and seasons. He was really good in Game of Thrones. He's doing really good work this year on The Expanse. But he's read the book and he did a book versus show comparison. And I guess in the book, they make it clear that like Earth is really fucked, like collapse of the biosphere fucked, 6 billion people dead. You know, like a fifth of the population in an instant dead, people starving. And they certainly didn't tell that story in the show. Do you think they're just hedging their bets to see if they want to make a big change between the books and the show for season six, or they want that to be a surprise? Or are you supposed to understand that Alpha Serala is like putting a brave face on it? What's your take on this?
So the timing of this is strange because those are book six. Spoilers. The book five hits the Earth with rocks. Book five doesn't deal with the real fallout of that. Just like the show doesn't deal with that in season five. So my opinion is they're waiting until season six to really reveal the true nature of it, whether they decide to change it or not from the books, whether it's not going to be as big a deal. Okay, maybe they've revealed it, but if they're going to reveal some further problems for Earth, then it's probably going to be in the next season.
Okay. That's surprising to me because I thought that like, you know, how would you not like if there's billions dead, how would you not know it in like real time? Like, why wouldn't you have, you know, maybe Alpha Serala doesn't have to dwell on it, but they've done really good job of just having like these news reports being in the background of terminals to kind of give us ideas of like what's going on at the Eero station, what's going on with the immigration to the ring gate systems. And it was just notably absent in the last few episodes. And so,
Yeah, okay. It feels like they're waiting and timelines get a little weird and fuzzy too, right? Like how long does it take to travel from X place to Y place?
Right.
During that time, how could the Earth not know the status of their environment? There are a lot of questions around timing that I have where they would almost certainly know these things, like not immediately. You wouldn't be sure about it because you have to wait for cascade effects, some kind of collapse of infrastructure, and only after, you know, a few weeks would people really start dying. Like you have the initial impacts, but then you gotta wait to see what the actual fallout is.
Yeah, the supply disruption, the power disruption, right. The food disruption. That's exactly. Where, you know, yeah, water. I mean, people start dying from thirst if they don't get water.
So how, you know, how long has it been since that has happened? It doesn't feel like very long from the Avasarala storyline, that it's maybe been less than a couple weeks. But then from all of the space travel that they're doing, and you know, everybody getting back to Earth and having this meeting where they talk about the future.
Naomi's face healing completely, having time to get Holden's parents, all of them up to right. Luna. Yeah.
Going into season six, I think we'll hear more about that.
It does feel ominous that all important people to us and to Earth's government seem like they're reconstituting on Luna.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Earth's little airless lifeboat. So I guess the final, maybe most important topic is what happened to the Martian separatists. I'm going to call them that, that tried to transit the Laconia gate. Because we have seen, Holden himself says that when he goes through the gate, he sees these fire extra dimensional entities getting angrier and angrier. We saw when the Belter scientist Okoye, I think is her name, stepped into the anti protomolecule particle. She saw visions of these red things like tearing shit up and stuff. This felt a little bit different because when the red beings were intersecting with like matter, you know, it looked like it was destroyed, that like things were exploding. Mm-hmm. And I watched when the ship was transiting the gate, like as it got through, like there's red stuff playing all over the portal itself. But the ship is not like breaking up or being destroyed or whatever. But the drive cone goes out, like there's still like a fourth of the ship to slide in. The drive cone stops working. That to me felt very ominous. But I also don't know like what that means. If this ship gets destroyed and there's no Martians on the other side, like, will we ever find that out? Because also they said, hey, we're slamming the door behind us. We're putting up the minefield. Don't ever try to get through it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So like the belt's not going to check on these people. There's probably not expecting any communications. Like what the hell? So what am I supposed to understand happened there? Do you care to give any insight, or
that's a good question. It's a little muddier, I think, in the show because you've got all this stuff with Holden, like showing Fred, here's what it looks like when I see these things in my dreams or whatever. And it looks very similar to what you're seeing happen to Savitaire. And I don't want to say too much, but I don't know too much more. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. Like I would say book six doesn't deal with those protomolecule details. So there's not too much more. It's one of the facets of this show that I'm looking forward to come season six.
That's wild.
Is knowing more about that.
Because the other thing about, like, if that ship gets destroyed, the big question then becomes, well, what happens to all that amazing protomolecule superstructure that's being built in space?
Yeah.
You know, like, if everyone that tries to go through a gate at this point is going to be eaten by the red fire demons, then what use is these giant orbital installations, perhaps battleships, whatever it is? Like, what good is that going to do anybody?
I will say it's not everyone. Going through the gate doesn't guarantee that the red stuff will happen to you.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Well, I mean, like I said, that just asks some more questions. Like, why do they eat some ships and not others? And was it just some gates, or is it all gates equal chance? And, you know, because like Holden says, they're getting angrier and angrier.
It is a big part of book six, but they don't, I don't think they ever actually give you an answer to the question, what happens to the ships that the red stuff affects?
Well, like I said, those are the big questions I had, you know? And I'm looking forward to seeing how, especially the thing, like, it just seems hard to believe that they're introducing this idea of these giant interstellar protomolecule, perhaps ships or installations being built, and they would just cut that off from any way of affecting the main plot, especially in context of, like, you know, the coy statements of like, oh, we always kind of thought we'd just stop with books with book six and season six. Like, it seems like there's going to be a lot of big questions kind of like still laying out there that they could either, you know, reboot a movie series or continue to do in seasons. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows what the future of this show looks like beyond season six, but I have all the same questions that you do for the most part. I think our listeners do too. A lot of these emails that we got are, you know, based around those things, those events.
Okay, because that's the other thing I wanted to talk about is like the what we thought about the future going past season six. But if the feedback is dealing with that, then I'm content to let it do that. So
yeah, we have a few.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Maybe I should jump right into them. If you want to send an email, you can do so at expanse@baldmove.com. We're probably not going to consider it until season six starts airing. So maybe hold off until then, because we'll get a lot more information, I imagine, about what season six is going to look like and potentially beyond season six. And maybe we can start with Gary from Houston here, considering our feedback, because he's got a question about that. What I really like to talk about is the final few minutes of the episode and read into what it means for the future of the Expanse property beyond season six. Given some comments from Ty and Dan on Twitter about there being a quote unquote pause after season six and several interviews that they have commented that they do not intend to cram books 7, 8, and 9 material into the final season of the show. Most book readers have been hopeful that we'll see more Expanse after the end of season six, whatever form that'll take. And he says the inclusion of the stinger at the end of season 5 all but confirms that, which I'm not sure I agree with, but we can talk about it here in a second.
All but confirms that they're not going to.
No, that they will. There will be more beyond season six.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, if they're not going, like if they're not, so they there's a couple things that are true. There exists a set of books, 7, 8, 9, yep. that are kind of like coupled into a trilogy in the same way that we now understand seasons 1 through 3 were, and that we will understand the season 4 through 6 are. And maybe you probably already understand how they fit together since you've already read those trilogy of books. There's another trilogy, and they are saying that they are not intending to like hurry up and shove those into season 6. So essentially do a super season 6 that has material from book 6, 7, 8, and 9. But they are suggesting that that material is going to be gotten into, but they're also saying that season 6 is the last season.
Yeah, it's wild to me because I don't feel like, yeah, I've said this in previous podcasts, that season 6 can end the way that book 6 does, and I will feel satisfied in that story. And so if that's the case, they have to do another season after this, and or after season 6. Yeah, otherwise, I just don't. It feels incomplete to me. Unless they're going to take the elements, which they say they're not, of 7, 8, 9 and try and cram some of them in, it just won't feel right.
That's why I keep saying that this feels like posturing to me. That, like, what the like, there's three sides here. There's Amazon. There is, what's the company that actually makes The Expanse? Alcon?
Yeah.
You got Alcon, and then you got Dan and Ty. And what Dan and Ty are saying is, we don't think we can make 7, 8, 9 on the budget that we have made 1 through 6 on. And thus, we are announcing that we are unilaterally ending the show because we want to keep Dominic Tipper and Stephen Strait and Wes Chatham and all these guys on as the cast. But we need to increase the budget and we want out of this deal. This feels like a superstar athlete that signed a rookie contract that's blown up. And now they're saying, I'm going to sit out training camp. Now, does that mean they don't want to play for that team anymore?
It's a Scottie Pippen.
It means that it's a Scottie. Yeah, there's you could have any number of athletes you could think of. But like, it's essentially saying they're not saying I don't want to play football. Or basketball. They're not saying I don't want to play basketball for the Chicago Bulls. What they're saying is they don't want to play the basketball for Chicago Bulls under the terms of the contract. So can we rip that up and come to a new understanding? And if not, I'll just continue to sit out and not play. I would be shocked if there is an episode 7, 8, or 9 or a movie series or a new studio getting it or a new outlet getting it. Just like we went through with the sci-fi kind of business. I would just be shocked. I think this is just a ploy, a negotiation in public. And we saw this with Marvel and Sony. That was a little bit more acrimonious, but and then like magically it just all got resolved, you know. Sure. We've over the fight over Spider-Man is what I was thinking about in particular. We're just seeing powerful interest negotiating, probably in good faith out in the public. And I think that we will hear before season 6, there are plans for 7, 8, and 9. So that's my thought, because I just, yeah. What else? Why introduce all this crazy shit that you're just not going to even get to?
Is it a case where, like, if you're the writers of the show, you're Ty and Dan, you're the production company, you're like, all right, we're going to make a show that doesn't have an ending. And if Amazon wants to be the person that cuts this show off, be the entity that cuts the show off, they're going to take the heat for that. But we're going to tell this thing like we're mid story and kind of force their hand a little. Total speculation.
Yeah, it's so weird because like I feel like I'm trying to feel an elephant in the dark. And, you know, because like I've heard you say that you would be you would think that ending season 6, ending things at season 6 as they stand in the books would feel like a massive, like there's more there and that you need to know and yeah. You're just never going to get it. Be disappointing. I've heard others say that like, oh, I actually understand that. And you'd have a complete, you'd have a fairly complete, ending with a, like, you know, intriguing kind of mystery that could be pulled for threads for future plots. And obviously, I don't, you know, I'm just hearing people kind of talk obliquely around it. I've heard rumors of like a big time jump going from book 6 to 7 that also could explain a little, but also like, I don't see how you can take like a huge time jump between what I understand the state of the board at the end of book six is going to be. You know, there's going to be, you know, probably a lot more war, but you're also got this protomolecule shit heating up. Like, I don't see how you can kind of come to an equilibrium in this universe to where you can set it for like 10, 15, 20, 30 years and have it come back and be fine. You know,
yeah.
Like, how do you do a time jump where you've got, you're leaving things that up in the air? I don't know. But like I said, it just feels like it's negotiating a new contract in public. And I'd be very surprised if the end result of those negotiations are no more Expanse after season 6. That's it.
Yeah, we'll see. Let's move on to Madi, who says, I was wondering what you guys thought about the idea that when you guys read the books in a series ahead of the show, like on Game of Thrones or Expanse, you lose a big part of what makes the podcast fun, speculation. Mildly interesting is cute, but what you're left with is one of you who speculates and the other who can't speculate at all, because even if it would have been a guess, they know the answer. I've already read all the books before this last season aired, so for me, this doesn't really matter as much in regards to the Expanse, and I wouldn't say you guys have to change for the podcast, but in my general opinion, when there's a show you guys are watching and podcasting, might not be best idea to be spoiled. All this to say still that now as a book reader, it's nice to hear Jim compare scenes to the book. So maybe I don't really have a point here. yeah. I mean, that's the push and pull here, right? Is like, by doing that, you're going to please the people who have read the books. And I think a fair number of people who've seen this show are also book readers, Expanse book readers. I think it doesn't have the 10 million plus 100 million, whatever people that were watching Game of Thrones. So it's not that skewed ratio toward the show nearly as much. But yeah, you do lose something. I don't like when I have to say mildly interesting. I much more enjoy just sitting down and shooting the shit and speculating, but
yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like this format was wildly successful in Game of Thrones. And I guess there's two points of that. Like, there is this kind of like slightly malicious glee in watching a person that doesn't know what's going to happen, like just twisting in the wind, and the other person kind of smugly doing the mildly interesting. The thing that I guess the thing that made that the completed the circle when we had a Game of Thrones is we had a spoiler edition.
Yeah.
And like, I guess that's the thing. Like, if there was a companion podcast that came out later in the week where you did a 30 minutes of like, here's the difference between the books and the show, and here's what Aaron's thinking, and here's what's actually happening, and you guys could speculate behind my back about stuff, like, that would probably close the circle. But like, you know,
well, it still doesn't solve the core problem of I can't speculate along with you. All I've got to do is nod along as you, you know, talk about what you think is going to happen, and I can't.
Yeah,
really,
but
respond.
You use the spoiler edition to speculate, to do the speculation of like, well, here's what happens in the books. And also, well, the thing also,
you know,
the
that
thing
doesn't
that
help the people who haven't read the books and don't want to be spoiled, right?
Right, but that's us, and then I'm speculating for them. I'm just saying, like, this, like, it was like we had the most successful Game of Thrones podcast at the time while we were doing that, and like, I think that's the only difference in this model, is that there is no outlet for the book people to like hear informed speculation of like, okay, here's where the books are going, here's where the show's going, how are they going to meet up, how are they going to be different. The spice in the Game of Thrones was the books weren't finished.
Yeah.
So there was still a ton of speculation you can do. By the time season 6 rolls around, I don't think that will be the case for the Expanse.
I don't think it was the case this season. Like, when you've got books 6, 7, 8 out there, like, right, you're so far ahead, I don't think there's any speculation to really do.
Okay. So then the speculation is just like, how are they going to adapt it for the show? You know, like, yeah, oh, this character is macho fucking Pac-Man or whatever. Like, that's the kind of stuff that, like, I think would be going, but like I said, that's up to you whether you want to do a spoiler edition for the Expanse, because it wouldn't be my project.
Yeah. All right. David says, a friend and I were debriefing after the finale, and I was struck at just how well the season was structured. It's a real triumph, and I think a high watermark for television as a whole, not just sci-fi. Mm. I really think Dan and Ty have learned from all the shows that have come before, and it really shows in little details and how they construct the various plot elements over an entire season. The attention to detail, the satisfying character arcs, even for secondary characters, and the adherence to internal consistency, all A+. As a consumer of television in general and sci-fi specifically, it really feels like Dan and Ty respect us, the audience. They don't talk down to us, they take writing seriously, and they learn from the history of the genre to make a better show each and every season. It's so refreshing and satisfying to see how this show and the cast and production have grown. I agree. I think one of the things, we talk about, we've nitpicked some of the things in this season, right? And I think that's part of the consequence of how well they have written this show in the past and how, they've pieced this together to where everything makes perfect sense and none of it is confusing. It's all just under the surface. If you even scratch the surface, you get what they're trying to do here. And, that's why when they do some things that are sort of confusing, it leaves us scratching our head and I guess wanting them to do the perfect job that they've done up until now.
Even if you agree with my takes on, our takes on the little bit of Sloppy Joe with Naomi's Chainsmoker plot. This still is like I said, Breaking Bad had at least two lapses where I was like, I don't know about this in the first three seasons. Fargo, every season, the first two seasons had a giant kind of logical lapse that always bothered me. There's very few shows that are just completely airtight start to finish.
Yeah.
The Expanse is well ahead of that game. And I do think that they have a good point there that Dan and Ty, as consumers of fiction, both in terms of the written form and video games and TV shows and movies, all that stuff, they have learned a lot from the golden age of television and puzzle box shows and how to keep a big cast in with a huge backdrop. And I think their big innovation is the crew, the Rocinante. If George had been able to quickly get Danny and John and Tyrion and I don't know who else would be Stannis, and they're in a boat going around getting in adventures around Westeros, and all three of the factions, all the factions are they're representative, and you wouldn't have to be going and seeing, she's stuck over here in Essos and this guy's stuck at the wall. And all this, you have that core adventure and then you have the backdrop. And that's a pretty good way to have that, where you have this massive theater that's happening, but you also have this very intimate story that you're able to tell. So
yeah,
kudos. And I have massive, the thing is at no point did I ever get to where with this show where I got with The Walking Dead, where I just throw my hands up and be like, well, this is just patently stupid. No. I have an enormous amount of faith in the production team and them pulling off a satisfying end of the story. I can't even imagine, even one kind of bad season probably wouldn't crush it. Or when I say bad season, I mean a bad season like Game of Thrones season 5 or 6. Or even 7, they built up so much goodwill that it would take a just truly terrible, atrocious season or several seasons of mediocre quality with a bad final season before I'd be like, yep, Dan and Ty pulled a double D. They just have a huge amount of credit with me. I'm looking forward to whatever they come out with in the future.
The thing I appreciate about the writing so much is a lot of lessons that, you're talking about from prior television, Breaking Bad, had this character driven plot. And that is one of the things that the show does so well. It, takes that core crew of the Rocinante, puts them in a situation, and then creates the tension from characters reacting naturally the way they would. It doesn't try to artificially insert that. And it goes even farther, right, to extend across the themes that they're trying to get to. Something like The Walking Dead will have a character flip-flop 8 times to try to shoehorn in the theme that they're talking about.
Right.
just to get the theme in there. The Expanse instead creates these super tense situations out of the choices the characters would naturally make, and then weaves those into the larger theme that they're trying to get at. And they have just done such an amazing job putting all that together in a way that just feels effortless. It feels seamless. And if they can keep that up through at least one more season, yeah, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be real happy with this show.
Yeah, and I love it, especially when you go through like the changes between the books and the TV show thus far. Almost always they're like positive tweaks.
Yeah,
like they just tightened up the plot a little bit more. They tightened up the characters a little bit more. They gave, you know, what was just kind of hinted at in the books, they actually gave a character time to, like, you know, fully express whatever they're trying to get to. Like, I felt like the books are kind of a dress rehearsal, or not a dress rehearsal, but like, you know, it's not just adapting what they've got. It's also like, well, what did we learn from the pains that we went through writing it in the first place? So let's adapt it for sure, but also maybe streamline and clean up some things and expand on others that we wanted to get to, especially when you talk about all the, you know, as I understand it, these satellite works, these short stories, these novellas that kind of fill in the gaps, bring some of that into the main narrative. That stuff is really smart. It's really smart.
For sure. All right. Has some questions and thoughts for the wrap up here. Who do you think gets to kill Marco, that motherfucker? As in, who deserves to hate him the most? And who do you want to see take him out? Top candidates, in my opinion, are Naomi, for obvious reasons. She hates his pastor, but I sort of think that given the opportunity, she won't kill him. Just maybe take their son's love away from him, if she can, by showing Philip who Marco really is. But still, maybe she'll kill him. Philip, basically, his dad has manipulated him and turned him into a monster, and he has plenty of reasons to commit patricide. Or Drummer, who I think hates him as much as anyone for obvious reasons. Personally, M wants to see Drummer kill him. What do we think?
I've got a take, and I think Marco doesn't die. I think Marco gets the what do you call this? He gets the Jean-Pierre Meow treatment, where he just gets ruined and imprisoned and not martyred and forgotten about, you know, like, that is the way to, you know, to bring someone to justice is. But on, honestly, on the other hand, you know, if someone that's got this much blood on their hands, there has to be someone that kills him. I think it should be Philip.
Yeah,
like it's a very Luke it's a very Luke Skywalker, you know, moment of like, you know, dealing with your family's history of complicity and true atrocities. Like the only way to do it sometimes is by letting of blood. And Naomi is the type that would just walk away. She'd be very much like, well, I don't want to make another martyr. I don't want to kill my son's father. Drummer, absolutely. Drummer, all she needs is a fucking means and a location. She doesn't need to wrestle with the morality of it. And I think probably Holden even, and like Amos is in that camp, and probably even Avicerala, like she said, like, yeah, I want to see this guy up on hooks. So I think Philip is the one that's the most interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think Naomi has gone a long way toward the goal that he talks about sort of removing whatever veneer of love Philip thinks is there between him and Marco. And so, you know, if she's going to have a hand in killing him, that's probably going to be the way it goes, is just turn Philip against him. But we'll have to see.
Yeah, when we watched it this weekend, I was like just struck again by how determined he looked as he was loading that weapon and holstering it. And like, I wouldn't have been shocking for him to just go up to his and just blow his dad's head off right then and there. I don't think he's ready yet. But that's a man, that's a young man who could be at that level pretty quickly.
And
like
it does
a few more lies and manipulations and a few more of his mom being like, you know, an unambiguous lauded hero. And I think you're going to get it.
It does make me wonder. Will Naomi have another opportunity? Because she had some opportunities this time.
It's true.
Is Marco still hell bent on destroying the Rossi? Is he going to be coming even harder after Holden next season, since he escaped his trap this season? You know,
The logical response by the combined UN, Belter, Martian task force is like the Rocinante must be protected at all costs. Like,
and maybe it's like used as bait to trap.
Yeah, like when you got Captain America going into war against the Nazis, like that's great because Captain America is going to war against the Nazis. But man, if Hitler ever kills Captain America, that's a huge blow both to your own side's morale, to his side's propaganda. Like,
yeah,
you know, you're propping these guys up as the shining heroes and like what humanity could be in the future. Well, that plays right. Like if Marco can kill that, then. So, like, I wonder if it'd be kind of a fun plot if there is this tension of, like, you know, Holden and Naomi and Bull, presumably, and Amos and Clarissa and Bobby wanting to go out there and mix it up and do good with, like, the joint command being like, there's no fucking way we can put you in danger, you know?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the season, Oliver Sorrella calls him, like, the face, essentially, of the United Earth or the inner Navy, right? Like,
and Holden saying like, hey, we don't carry a flag and this is a fight we can't stay out of. There's tension all because he's already saying like, I'm not going to follow anyone's orders, but also I want to make sure I'm in this fight. That kind of like, if you read between the lines, puts them at odds against the, you know, the political powers that be. So interesting.
M has another couple questions here. Other thoughts? Do you think Naomi will have any residual trauma from her ordeal in season 5, and will it be depicted in season 6?
I don't know. Does she feel traumatized? I felt like she felt like she was in control and had her own agency, but then again, that doesn't have anything to do with how you feel trauma.
I don't know that she's going to have a ton of trauma from like the physical, you know, being oxygen deprived and her spacewalk and stuff like that. But emotional trauma, is it any different than the emotional trauma? The only emotional trauma I can see is coming from her reuniting with Philip. That's where it's at, right? Because her relationship with Marco has not changed, like, other than him trying to kill her, but she probably had to figure he would want to do that anyway. It's all surrounding Philip. Like, what is their new relationship? Do they even have one? It doesn't seem like she believes that coming out of season 5.
Yeah, and there's the whole question, like, there's two things here. Like, is it realistic for someone to deal with trauma in this way? Because arguably, like, this, she's been through this kind of trauma before when she originally decided not to throw herself out of the airlock and the walk away, right? So she's got, you know, she's been down this road before. She's got experience with it. On the other hand, it is also realistic for someone to experience another trauma, to, you know, be re-traumatized and to have a setback. And you got to balance all that about what we know about PTSD with also what's dramatically interesting. And I don't know what Dan and Ty think about the dramatic interest of having Naomi realistically grapple with trauma, because, you know, maybe that's not something interesting that they want to explore with the only female member of the crew. Right.
Sure.
Maybe that's that they'd see that as kind of being just leaning into stereotypes or whatever.
And they're doing a lot of that with audience. Claire already. Like, I don't know that I really need every woman on the ship to be having an emotional crisis at every point during the show.
Right. Like, every single one of them. That's the thing, is every single member of the Rocinante could be entirely justified to go in their quarters and just sobbing for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
But like, what the hell kind of show does that look like? So. I don't know. I guess I'm voting for probably not as much processing of trauma.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was processed when she came back and played the message with Holden. That was a moment for them to both, you know, decompress and gather themselves emotionally. So we'll see.
Plausible. Sure.
Ashley in Kansas says, holy smokes, I can't believe how much happened in the last episode. Death of Alex, I was not expecting the Cass Anbar thing to take place in this episode. I assumed it would play out at the beginning of next season. However, I like how you guys said it on the last wrap-up and how Amos said it. Alex was a hero who died saving a family member. I also think about the season he had. He shot up with strange drugs, boozing, and beat up. It was a rough season for Alex. All of that along with the crazy drugs for the high-speed travel really make it feel more possible that he would stroke out. I like the season, but it does feel like it was 9 episodes built up for this one. And I wish that there was an 11th episode of this season instead of the ring stuff happening at the end of this, with maybe a little more story. One of my favorite characters is Drummer, and I would have liked to have her meet up with Rocinante. I would have liked Drummer's remaining team to meet Naomi and their team, and showing the extension of this Belter Martian Earther friendship. maybe even Drummer on Luna being awkward but trying to make peace, possibly. And giving her a mission to sort of reunite humanity as a whole with the Belters. What do you guys think if there was an 11th episode to play out and expand on those last few minutes? What else would you have inserted into episode 10? More Eric? Better unfold of Peaches being in the crew? More Bobby? That last one you bring up is actually interesting. And I think we have somebody else who wrote in to talk about how Sanjeev wrote in to say, I agree with you guys that the show handled the death of Alex pretty well, and there were some nice scenes with the Rossi crew members, but he was surprised to hear or see that we didn't get a similar one from Bobby because she was so close to Alex during this season, and even more so in the books. That would have probably been like a capper for this season that we didn't necessarily need, but would have been nice to remember Alex, because she would be one of the people who was most fond of him, right?
Yeah, they're both Martians, and they definitely seemed like they were building something between. But like, man, I find it hard to fault them not giving these characters all moments to grieve Alex, because that was not the game plan. That was like, oh shit, we got a week of reshoots and our week of redoing VFX and stuff. Like, how do we get this done?
They could have got also her like on a lot of webcam from her house and just like green screen behind her and had her just give some monologue, like write out a couple paragraphs. We could film that in an hour. Call us, Amazon.
But I also think that like, I understand what the first emailer especially said about like wanting those an 11th episode, but like also you're kind of starting to tread on future seasonal work, you know, like, yeah, like the show does this really well. Like, I remember when I was being borderline outraged at the time jump that we had in season three, because I'm like, god damn it, they've split Bobby from the Rocinante, and that looked fun, and Prax is gone, and like that, and that lasted for about half an episode until I was like, you know, on to the next thing.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, it's gonna be fun. Like, it'll be fun to see Drummer and Holden in like a hunter killer pack, you know, like trying to pounce on Belter terrorists, and you know, trying to hunt down this and that Martian separatists. It's going to be a lot of fun. So like, why waste that stuff in like a throwaway scene at the end, or even like have this like, I mean, I think if you actually did that, you'd have a lot of people complaining that like, god damn, it seems like there's just a lot of epilogue to this season.
Yeah, there already was.
There already was like, this felt very Return of the Kings with all the extra in. So it's like some of those things, like, be careful what you wish for, because if you got it, like, what does that do to the pacing? What does that do to how fun it's going to be next season to see these characters kind of like, you know, meeting up and working together? And how's that even going to look? And yeah,
that's why I kind of zoned in on the Bobby and Alex stuff, because I don't have enough that I would want to see for an 11th episode. I guess I just have a sixth ending that I would want to see, but yeah, there are probably
Bobby standing up in her Jetsons uniform to give a little eulogy about the compadre, my favorite compadre.
Yeah. All right. Anthony Yu says, you're wondering what Marco Anaro's motivation could possibly be for shutting down the Soul Ring. I think it's economic. The Belter's sole source of income is mining the asteroid belt for the resource poor inner planets. If there's a mass exodus from the inner planets to the ring worlds, the inner planets will no longer need the Belters. On top of that, most Belters like Naomi can't survive on the ring worlds, which means they'd be stuck here after everyone else leaves. probably forced to live in even greater poverty than they do now. Yeah, it's a good point. You have endless resources like lithium on Illus, for instance. You probably don't need to be out there doing the really hard work of mining the vast road belt.
Yeah, it does. That's the thing. It does feel like the belter physiology that, like, you know, either the belters can adapt and become well wallas again, which is a form of cultural genocide, or they never can. And they're for generations held out from seeing the wealth of these new, you know, these new systems being exploited, and they're completely shut out of it. So, like, it does make a certain amount of sense from this point of view with historically how the belters have been treated. Makes a lot of sense.
Let's go to Jim, who says, I really love this season of The Expanse. Wanted to comment on what I thought was an awesome and thoughtful execution of Naomi's escape / rescue from the Chainsmoker. Even as a book reader, they left me wondering if Naomi was going to make it. And the show made some interesting choices to put us in that spacesuit with Naomi. Also, with little direct explanation or exposition, they did a good job showing us the stakes. There's one thing we knew from our time in the ship. It was that the suit only had a tiny bit of air inside. And with that said, did they ever really explain why she was scribing on the wall for every trip out of the pressure hull of the Chainsmoker? It was a great way to show us how many times she had gone out there and set the stakes for the big jump at the end. But what was the purpose of her scribing on the wall for Naomi?
So before you answer that, because I think you got a definitive answer, I'll tell you what I thought just watching a show without any book knowledge. Uh-huh. I thought that she was keeping track of what relays she was going to in the ship, like presumably just like imagine if you had to go run down your basement and flip a circuit breaker and there is full of carbon dioxide. So yep. Like you had to hold your breath, run down to the basement, go in your garage, flip a circuit breaker, run back up and see if the light turned on. Like, and you don't want to waste any trips, like, because this is dangerous stuff. So, like, breaker one, you'd be like one breaker. Breaker two, breaker three, you keep on taking. I thought that's because I thought there was even like signs, like it was like CM-1 was one panel. So I thought she's keeping track of that. But then she kept doing it after she went to the bang valve strategy. So that clearly I didn't have the whole picture. Do you have any insight of what actually she was tracking?
Yeah, so as I understand it, there's a vacuum between the hulls, and I think that vacuum comes from the fact that the outer hull is not airtight.
Right.
And that's the reason why she needed to have her suit on when she went between those hulls. So every time she went back there and she used up whatever oxygen she had in her suit and made the check mark, she was saying, okay, I've used up this much oxygen from inside the ship. Because she has with the life support systems turned off, she has a limited amount of air inside the ship itself, and it's not getting recycled. It's not getting, you know, recreated. So every time she goes out there and loses that air, it's less air in the ship, and she can only do that X amount of times before she no longer has any air in the ship and she just passes out and dies.
Does she know what that number? Because that's the thing. It's like, I don't she, like,
yeah, in the book, all of this is in her series. Head and you can read her thought process. And she is like talking about, okay, there's X amount of air in the ship. And I know that every time I use my suit, I get rid of this much air. So I have this many times that I can do this. Yeah, it's much clearer in the book, but I thought they did a really good job of without having her talk to herself, which is a trope. Just kind of explaining through the visuals what she's doing for the most part. And obviously people were confused. You know, Jim here is confused. Aaron, you said you were a little unsure what she was doing. So yeah, I thought they did a good job though.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, Brent says, hey guys, thanks for another podcast season of The Expanse. Two topics for you to possibly discuss. One, now that there are five seasons, how would you rank each of them from your most to least favorite? Is this something we can do off the top of our heads? I've got an approximation. 3, 2, 4, 5, 1.
I think 3, 4, 5 are all virtually indistinguishable in terms of goodness. And then 2 is better than, and those are all collectively better than season 2, which is collectively better than season 1. Not by huge amounts, but the show got better, the acting got better, the budgets got better, the effects got better, and the plot got more interesting. I think that 3, 4, 5 are all of it. Kind of like the same with Breaking Bad. Like, you know, you got 1 and 2, and then like, boy, 3, 4, 5 are just breakaway, breathless thrill ride. And I feel like that's what The Expanse has gotten to. Like, there hasn't been a wet blanket season. Like, I mean, right. People want to say that, like, I don't know, maybe season 5 is a little this or a little that, but like, I don't know.
Season 5 is different. And that's
season 4 was different. So
sure. Yeah. Season 5 and 4 were very different from the first three. And that kind of leans into his second question here. He says, I found it interesting that Holden was not a primary character this time around. What do you think of this season's approach of having the main cast all doing their separate things rather than being together?
I thought it was pretty great because it shows like, and All Shift X made a really good point about this. It was like the Holden's character, you know, he was always been surrounded by family. You know, he had like 8 moms and dads. Then he went into the military where, you know, you've got all your brothers and sisters there. Then a large ship, like, then everyone kind of and him needing everyone and everyone needing him. And, you know, his whole thing is communication, right? He has to communicate with people even when it's not smart. And him being cut off from that was an interesting character development for him. Like, he was not in control. He was out of communication with his family. He couldn't protect them. They couldn't watch his back. And that was like a really interesting development for him, which I thought was really cool. I really like that. And it's the first time that, like, you know, like I've loved Alex ever since the beginning, but like, he's never been like a forefront character. Giving him a chance to be a forefront character was great. Mm-hmm. Also kind of nice to see some early, really good solo Alex work before we had to say goodbye with him, to him.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, we've said a bunch about the Naomi side of that. So I really enjoyed, you know, and it felt all organic, like, hey, we just got done with this big adventure. Our ship's wrecked. We've got some personal business we need to attend to. It didn't feel forced or writerly. It felt very organic. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, Amos and Naomi are the main focus of this season, but also you're right too, Aaron. The stuff they're doing with Alex is stuff that you kind of needed before that character went out. Like if we never got any resolution from Alex's side, right? If he didn't understand that this relationship with his family was over, I don't think that would have felt like a complete character. And I think like a lot of that is the sacrifice, right? It all feeds back in because when he sacrifices himself to save his new family, that comes full circle and it feels right to me. It feels like a moment where I don't feel bad about that character going out because they've understood and done everything that they felt like they needed to.
100%.
Good stuff there. But yeah, I don't know. It was definitely different, but I knew it was coming from reading the books because they're structured the same way. Like the Illis stuff is all, you know, happening on Illis. And then after that, they all go their separate ways. So it wasn't a surprise to me. I guess the surprise here was how well it worked in the TV show. So then Virgilio writes in and he's got something he noticed about this, a particular part of this season. Because after watching Nemesis Games, I rewatched season 5 and noticed a minor but potentially fatal mistake made by Bobby. In episode 6, after fighting off the Belter boarding party and blowing up their skiff, Bobby finds a pesky bullet that made it through her mech suit. She turns down the autodock, since it just itches, and discards the bullet. Well, as we all know, especially from season 3, that anything unsecured could be lethal during high G maneuvers. Fortunately, it looks like they flew straight at high G and didn't need to make any combat maneuvers. I do wonder, though, if they could have worked that bullet into Alex's death.
That last breaking runs a bitch.
God, what does that do to Bobby? If the bullet that bounces off of her, essentially, and she discards thoughtlessly, kills Alex. Oh, God, that changes everything about that scenario.
I'm trying to think about like what a single bullet going even 19 G's,
right,
accelerating a 19 G's would actually do to you, because it's all like, you know, what is it? An ounce of lead? Probably not.
How many G's do you think a gun accelerates a bullet at?
So I saw some people trying to count, because this is normally not something you talk about in terms of bullets, right?
Yeah.
But like the initial acceleration of a bullet is something around 12,000 G's.
Oh,
you know, going from 0 to 300 meters per second or 3,000 meters per second for like your average.
Okay, NATO, but that's
5.56 round.
It's also not linear acceleration, right? So it might be different if you. Well, no, I guess the only acceleration would come. Yeah, just like constant acceleration. But I guess that wouldn't be the case with the bullet coming off the floor anyway. So
yeah, I'm trying to think of like the most extreme maneuver, you know, is like 50 G's. So like it's going to make a. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Doesn't seem like it would really be that much of a threat.
Right. But it's just a funny thing to think about, her just casually tossing that bullet over and then like right. You got this foreign object debris rattling around in the cabin and it's bouncing around and it just nicks, you know, his artery, or especially since it seems like he was kind of like his health is marginal in the first place, you know. Like what would, but yeah, I don't know. It sounds like the Mythbusters where they tried to calculate how much force it would take to kill. Like if you got in a head on collision with a box of Kleenex in the rear view in the rear window, well, and that hit you right in a corner, could it pop? Like, I don't know. But it is funny to think about the survivor guilt of her.
Oh, God.
Tanking that bullet with her suit and then it taking out Alex.
Yeah. And finally, Sean says, really enjoyed this season. I'm looking forward to season 6. However, I do have one worry. The writers have so far shown that they are not D&D, who we know from Game of Thrones, but I still can't help but get season 8 Game of Thrones vibes from The Expanse due to how its last season is currently set up. Similar to Thrones, where the good guys had to go through the Night King, Cersei, and Dany in a limited run of episodes, the good guys in The Expanse will now have to go through Marco, the Rogue Mars faction, the Protomolecule, and the Red Fire Demons. This seems like a bit much for 10 episodes, no?
Yeah, you're right. You've got like two antagonists, the Martians, the Belters. You've got the Red Demons. You've got the Protomolecule species.
Which if they're not actually going to try and get through all that, that makes a lot more sense. If they're just going to do a season 6 that is the book 6, and leave a lot of stuff open-ended, that would make a certain amount of sense.
Yeah. But like I said, I've got a huge the thing is around season 4 or 5 on Game of Thrones, I had similarly high quality of or high degree of confidence in the double D's. Then you had progressively more questions progressively. And I kept on extending that credit until, you know, so like. What would that look like for The Expanse? I guess The Expanse, like if we had a couple quibbles, if next year we had twice the amount of quibbles, and then the year after that, like, you know, in a hypothetical season 7, if that started falling apart. But the other thing is, like, you know, if we had Winds of Winter out and people thought it was good, but the other crucial thing about if we're really worried about Game of Thrones target fixation, the other crucial difference is. Consensus, George's best work was years behind him. Like, everyone loved Game of Thrones, Clash of Kings, Storm of Swords, and then consensus was Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons were a little bit messier and steps in maybe the wrong direction, but also people were giving him a lot of because, like, that was the part of the story where everything had blown up to its maximum extent and it was time to start coming together.
Yeah.
And we never got that coming together. As by all accounts, like the first 8 books of the Expanse cycle, there's only one more left, and all 8 books have been very confidently and competently told. You know, it's not like things stopped at Nemesis Gate, and then it's like, well, we're just going to assume that a thing like they're continuing to crank out these books on a regular schedule at a very high quality.
Yeah.
So they're really not, and they're directly involved in the writer's room. So, yep. Like, there's very little commonality between Expanse and the Game of Thrones other than season 5 of both of those shows had a quibble or two. But what is the case for there to be more quibbles building up, fatal quibbles in the Expanse versus Game of Thrones, where, honestly, season 5 and 6 were where we started to go off book anyway? We're right. Not off book yet.
We won't ever be off book. Like,
we're never going to be off books.
Yeah, book 9 is supposed to come out this year, so the conclusion will be there when they're ready to write it for the show. I see very little chance of this being a Game of Thrones level catastrophe. I could certainly see a future in which the ending just doesn't land.
Or they never get
to do the landing.
Or there's people that are just not satisfied with the landing, regardless of, you know, you're always going to get that, right?
Sure.
You know, you're always going to have some people, no matter how excellent something is, there's going to be some people that don't like, just even people that don't like the Lord of the Rings films, even though those are widely regarded as some of the best adaptations in movie history. So I just think that, like, there's superficial similarities between Game of Thrones and The Expanse. But, like, if you really think about it in terms of the body of the original work, the completion of it, how well it's regarded. Like, it's not like, you know, what's the next book? It's Nemesis Games. And then,
dude, you could ask me, I can probably rattle off most of the book names, but I have no idea what order they are. I think Leviathan Wakes is number one.
I think it's Da Vinci Code is the next one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, you know, like, it'd be one thing if, like, it stopped at, like, if, like, the last two books were Ciabatta Burn Nemesis Games, and those were kind of like, people were like, eh, and that's all we got, and we're staring down a season 6 of, like, that's not what we've got here. It's not at all.
Yeah.
So I have the faith. I got the faith. I'm keeping the faith.
You know, we do have another season of podcasting in the bag. That's the final email this week and for this season.
Yeah, and I guess if, you know, this is your first introduction to our work, or maybe you haven't listened to us much else, obviously Bald Move doesn't stop now. We are going to go and start our retrospective coverage of The Walking Dead Season 10, which we're pretty excited to get back to. That's going to be starting in the next week or two. We also still have Sci-Fi Sundays going to continue with us watching Star Trek and a classic sci-fi movie each week. We're waiting to see what comes out of the Prestige television, but we do know that we're going to be watching some great prestigious films from all of film history. We're going to be cherry picking some good ones to talk about on Bald. So there's tons and tons of stuff to talk about baldmove.com. And I would, if you're a big fan of science fiction fantasy, please subscribe to our Pulp podcast. That kind of is the where we wrap up all of our, you know, spaceships, robots, dragons, magic, larger than life stuff. And if you like, you know, high quality drama, which Expanse happens to be both, it's pulp sci-fi and high quality drama. Check out Bald Move Prestige, because that's where we do, you know, the Oscar winning films, the serious prestige dramas, et cetera, et cetera.
And our Bald Move annual Bald Move Awards, the Baldies. We're releasing that podcast either today or tomorrow. So that's kind of the culmination of everything we watched last year.
And check out to see fun. How the Expanse did.
Yeah.
How high did it rank on the dramas? Did any of the principals get actor awards? Lots of pageantry and drama over on the Baldies, our fake ass award show. Yeah. And also subscribe at Bald or follow at Bald Move on Twitter if you want to keep up the latest and greatest, too. And of course, you can always just stop by baldmove.com whenever to see what we're doing. But yeah, hopefully you continue with us in some form on one of those endpoints, and we'll see you real soon. If not, please be back here for season 6 of The Expanse, because whether it comes out all at once or hopefully week by week, we will have some form of coverage for it, because goddamn, yeah. I love this show. And that'll do it. Until the next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.